Turn in our Bibles to Mark chapter 5, and today we have two very familiar stories that are recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke about the woman who touches the hem of Jesus' garment and the young girl who is raised from the dead. And these are familiar stories to many of you, but we don't want to forget that we have many children here, younger children and even older children in our midst. They haven't heard as many sermons as some of those of us who are older. And besides that, it's not about how much we already know or are familiar with God's Word. It's really about how much are we applying it in our own lives from day to day. We need daily and weekly reminders. And as I've been meditating on this passage all week long, it has really been a blessing, you know, to me, even though I'm very familiar with it. And I want to personally ask myself these questions. You know, what can I learn from these stories? How does it apply to me? What did Jesus intend for his disciples to learn? And since I'm a disciple of Jesus, what should I be learning from this? How will I allow the stories that we study today to change me, to make me different? That's what I'm thinking about. So let's start with verse 21. It says, "Now when Jesus had crossed over again by boat to the other side, a great multitude gathered to him, and he was by the sea." So if you remember last week, we talked about him crossing over the Sea of Galilee from the shore of Capernaum, where he had been teaching. He crossed over. He met the man of the tombs, delivered him from a legion of demons. The people didn't want him to stay around, the country people. They asked Jesus to leave, and so he comes back. It's likely less than a day has passed. We don't know exactly how much time, but Jesus didn't linger long over on the other side of Galilee. So he comes back, and when he comes back, the group, the multitude that had been listening to him teach are still there. They haven't left. They're waiting for him. And once again, we don't know how long that time was, but they were certainly on the lookout. When is Jesus going to come back? You know, and they're waiting in anticipation, and all of a sudden someone spots a boat. There's a boat coming. They probably didn't have binoculars, but maybe someone with keen eyes could say that it looks like the boat. Now, let's talk about this multitude that had gathered to hear him teach. They hadn't left. I don't know about you, but when I hear the word multitude, I immediately think of 5,000 plus people sitting on a mountainside hearing Jesus teach. That's just what comes to my mind. Maybe something else comes to your mind. But when I hear multitude, that's what I think. And that definitely is a multitude. It's a large multitude. But actually, in the most generic sense, the word multitude just means a crowd. That's what it means. And so a multitude can be 5,000 plus people on the mountainside. That's actually described in the Bible as great multitudes. So, you know, so there's a multitude, there's a great multitude, and there are great multitudes of people. That would be the 5,000 plus. Well, this today is a great multitude. It's not just a small gathering of people. It's a large enough group to define. This isn't just 50 people. This isn't just 100, maybe. Maybe there's hundreds. Maybe there's thousands. We don't know. But they were still at the shore where he had left them. And in Luke's gospel, it tells us specifically that they had waited. They had no idea how long he was going to be gone. How could they know? They didn't know he was leaving. But how in the world would they know that he's coming back? Well, we're in a similar situation. We know Jesus is coming back. And we believe he's coming back soon. But are we waiting in anticipation? These people had no idea when he would come back. For all they knew, he was going on a month-long mission trip. Maybe some keen people were like, well, they didn't look packed, like they were packed for a long journey. But whatever it was, by faith, they waited on that shore for him and his disciples to come back. But there were, out of that multitude of people, we have two stories today of two people in particular who are waiting on pins and needles in anticipation of Jesus coming back to the shore. And we were introduced to the first one in verse 22. And behold, one of the rulers of the synagogue came, Jairus by name, and when he saw him, he fell at his feet. Now, a ruler of a synagogue, let's do a little backdrop here. A ruler of a synagogue was similar to like an overseer, almost like a pastor, more like an administrative leader in a synagogue. So that's who this was. He was a leader in the synagogue of Capernaum. Now, we also should keep in mind, because we don't sometimes think about this when we're reading through the story, well, what else do we know about the synagogue in Capernaum? Well, in Mark chapter 3, we read a story about the synagogue in Capernaum and a man with a withered hand. And Pharisees and scribes and religious people who were set against Christ and actually plotting for his murder. That's happening in the synagogue of Capernaum. And Jairus here is one of the overseers. He's a ruler of the synagogue. We don't know what side he took, do we? We don't know. Did he side more with Jesus healing a man on the Sabbath? Did he side more with the Pharisees because they were powerful and influential? You can imagine, depending on what side he landed, how this could be a precarious situation for Jairus to come and fall at Jesus' feet. That's part of the backstory we don't know for certain, but we do know that if this was the synagogue that he was a ruler of, then he would definitely be in a conflict prior to this. And you know, what side had he taken? And now he's in this desperate need. You know, when it's somebody else's infirmity, the man with the withered hand, that's somebody else's story. And it's easy to try to remain neutral because it doesn't personally affect him. It's just between Jesus, a man with a withered hand, and these Pharisees. But that's not the case anymore. Now we're talking about his only daughter, which we'll see in the story and you're familiar with, is at death's door. And now he can't stay neutral anymore. He has to make a choice. And, you know, if he had to choose, okay, if I had to side with someone right now in my need, do I want to go to the Pharisees? Have I ever seen them heal anybody? In fact, these grumpy guys, that's all they do is complain and cause trouble and agitate people. I've never seen anybody healed. In fact, I've seen people, you know, probably get sick. Well, I'm sick of them. But Jesus, on the other hand, everywhere he goes, people are healed. And yes, we had this controversy. He healed on the Sabbath, and that was theologically incorrect. But yet, my daughter is at death's door. Out goes the debate of the theological matters. He's not thinking about whether it was right for Jesus to heal the man with the withered hand on the Sabbath or not. What he's thinking about is Jesus' power. He has power to heal, and I'm going to go humble myself before Jesus. And that's what we encounter here on the shore. But before we go any further in the story, I feel it's important, because I like to think about Scripture from this. I like to try to imagine as much as possible the scene. What's happening here? Because as you read it, we need to realize and think about that Jairus cannot simply walk up to Jesus, can he? There is a multitude. We've seen what happens when multitudes throng, and that's the word that's used several times, that they thronged Jesus. You can't get near the guy. And in one case, which we read in Mark, desperate men took a man on a pallet and uncovered the roof to lower him down just to get him into the presence of Jesus. So you just, even if you have a dire need, your daughter's dying, you want to humble yourself, ask him for help, you simply cannot approach him. You are going to have to run the gauntlet. You're going to have to contend with a multitude And that's what I want us to think about. And what I'm going to convey here as I have imagined the story is strictly imaginative. We don't have these details. It's just me thinking about this story and how it might have played out with Jairus. And let's go back to maybe the day before or early in that day when he's faced with a decision. His daughter takes a turn for the worse. The doctors are giving no hope. They're saying she's at death's door. She could die at any moment. And this man is now faced with a serious decision. Do I stay here with my daughter as she is dying, where a father should be, if he can be, at the side of his young daughter? Or do I send someone out to try to find Jesus? Or do I go myself? Those are the options he's faced with. We know which option he took. He is so desperate that he does something that's almost unthinkable, and possibly he could have been held in derision by family members, maybe his wife, going, "Why? What are you thinking of? Our daughter is about to die, and you're going to leave her? You're going to leave the bedside to go after a man that you don't even know if you can find him? And if you find him, you don't know if he'll come. And if he comes, you don't know for certain that he will heal her." Those are all the things that he has to wrestle with. Do I stay? Do I go? Do I send someone? No, I can't send someone because I can't trust that they'll make the appeal. What if they didn't make the appeal to Jesus strong enough? If they get to him and he doesn't come, I would blame them and I would blame myself for the rest of my life if my daughter dies. So you can see the amount of turmoil that would be in a father for his only daughter in this case. So he's in agony. He decides he's going to run the risk. He's going to try to find Jesus. And I'd like to think, in my version of as I imagine the story, that he actually came earlier in the day. And what does he find? A multitude of people thronging Jesus, and Jesus is completely unapproachable. He's in a boat teaching. And imagine Jairus in his desperation for the sake of his daughter trying to work through the crowds. If you've ever been in a situation like that where you're trying to move through a crowd and you just can't seem to press through, but he is so determined, he's pressing through, he's trying to get to the front. When he gets to the front, that's still going to be an obstacle because Jesus is not even accessible. He's in a boat teaching. And you can imagine people who know, I mean, he's a leader in Capernaum. People know him. He's one of the rulers of the local synagogue. And it's like, hey, what right do you have to push and shove and try to budge in front of us? Everybody else has, we all want a front row seat. Yeah, but you don't understand. My daughter's dying. But he finds his way, works his way through that crowd. It could take him most of the morning. The whole time he's not even hearing Jesus teach. That's not what he cares about at that moment. He just wants to get in Jesus' presence. But by the time he gets towards the front, and he's thinking, what am I going to do when I finally get within earshot of Jesus? Will I interrupt him teaching? Will he give me the time of day? What does he find? Jesus stops teaching, pulls up anchor, and takes off. You ever feel like that's happening in your life? In your moment of desperation and need? And you're saying, I'm making steps. I'm trying to reach out to Jesus. But as I try to reach out to him, he seems to get further from me. And now I can just imagine as he is watching that boat head to the other side, just the grief and the sense of failure. But he's a man on a mission, and men don't give up, especially when they're on mission. And so he's thinking, can I get a boat? Maybe there's a little boat somewhere that I can hire, and someone can row me out to Jesus, and I can convince him to come back and save my daughter. But as we saw in the story last week, where are all the little boats? They're all out with front row seats with Jesus, hearing him preach. And it says that when he went, they all followed him. They were out there with all the little boats. There's no little boats left. They're all out with Jesus and they're all going off into the sunset. You know, they're fading into the horizon. And here's a man in his desperation. I can just imagine him falling on his knees, crying out, "Oh God, what can I do?" Now, an interesting thing happens. He can see that everybody else is sticking around. Nobody's going anywhere. You would think that, okay, the great teacher, he's left the stage, he's gone off, it's time for the crowd to disperse. But nobody is dispersing. He might even ask people, like, what's going on here? I mean, why are you, well, we're hoping he'll come back. Well, do you know that he's coming back? No, we don't know that he's coming back. So why are you staying here? Because we hope it's worth staying for. It's interesting when a new technology is being released or a new video game or something, you'll see in the news where people will camp out all night long for the release of something. I mean, they're in such anticipation and hope of something that's not eternally important, but they'll do it. And they'll camp out to get their tickets or to get their new device. But these people are so captivated with Christ that they stay on the shore. They have no idea when he's coming back, but they are not going anywhere. Many of them had budged up to the front. Maybe they had been working all day towards the front. Maybe they had needs too. Who knows how many sicknesses, diseases, dying people they all represented. And they're all there and they said, "We are not going anywhere." That's what Jairus finds himself in at that moment. They are not leaving, and now he's stuck again with a decision, the same decision that he had before. Do I stay and wait for Jesus, who may not return? My daughter at this very moment may be dying. And what do I do? If I stay here and my daughter dies, could I live with myself? If I tried to find one of the members of my congregation, ask them, "Hey, could you stay here?" Could I trust them if Jesus does come back to make the appeal that only a father could make on behalf of his daughter? No, I can't trust them. So he is in a quandary, but he stays. He is there waiting, because that's the first thing that Jesus encounters when he hits the shore, is Jairus coming and falling on his knees before him. But before that happens, imagine now this moment, in these moments of agony where we don't know how long Jesus was gone, but it had to be hours at least, where he crosses over, he goes and heals the demoniac, he spends time teaching him, interacts with people, and eventually they come back. So it's got to be hours at least. And here are the people waiting on the shore. They see the boats begin to disappear. And then something happens that's a little bit freaky. We don't think about the people on the shore who all of a sudden see the weather change and a big wind kick up that seems so ominous, and the waves become agitated to where you're thinking, should anybody be out on the sea right now? I mean, this... And I'm sure that Jairus might in his own heart be thinking, wow, that's a wicked storm kicking up. Maybe, just maybe God's heard my prayer, and maybe this storm will drive Jesus back this way. Maybe they'll abandon wherever they're going. They'll turn around. They'll come back out of the storm. But instead of that happening, they're watching the storm, and everybody on the shore sees the same thing. All of a sudden, the wind stops immediately. The sea turns to glass. I mean, that would be pretty neat to see. But you'd wonder, what in the world is going on out there? Of course, they're still waiting and waiting and waiting. And it probably seemed like a lifetime to Jairus. And they're hoping, looking. Finally, they spot a little boat. You got people on the lookout. I see a boat. I see a boat. Could be Jesus. Hope rises, and then hope falls. It's one of the little boats that follow Jesus out onto the lake. They've now they come back with a crazy story of a freak storm and how they got separated from the main boat, and now they've come back to tell tales. And another boat, and another boat. All those little boats coming back to shore. Every time one comes and they spot it, you can imagine the hope rising and the hope falling. How many times have you found yourself in that same situation? Not only do I feel that Jesus is distant from me, I'm looking for him, but he's not answering. And then things that seem like answers are not the answers. And it's like my heart is being tugged one way and the other. I have hope that rises, and then I'm discouraged because it's not the answer. Hope and discouragement, hope rising, hope falling. But I hope in this, as I kind of imagine this, and this whole time his daughter may be dying at any moment, and likely is, you know, I hope you feel it a little bit better. You know, I hope you feel what Jairus must have been feeling. And I hope that, and the other thing too is he doesn't know what Jesus is up to. He didn't know that Jesus was heading to the other side to deliver a man who is in need of compassion. And he made a special trip just for that. A demon-possessed, crazed man, bloody, naked, and seemingly unworthy of such concern and care from Jesus. We know the story, though. And so you can imagine if he had known what Jesus was doing, thinking through your mind, why is it that it seems like people like that are getting help from Jesus? And I'm the good person. I'm a leader in the synagogue. I don't do anything wrong. I try to help people. I keep my nose clean. I'm a good guy. I love my family. And yet, Jesus is dropping everything to go help some half-crazed or fully crazed, demon-possessed man across the sea, while the person who's living an upright life, goes to church, pays their tithes, you know, seems to be getting no help from Christ. I feel overlooked. You ever feel overlooked? And you ever hear those testimonies, you know, of the maybe you listen to stories of just people that were completely lost and broken and God's doing these amazing things in their life, and you're like, man, I'm a good person. I go to church and I'm not a drug dealer. I'm not killing people. I'm not doing anything crazy. And yet, why do I feel like I'm overlooked? And what happens is when we begin to see that, we begin to question God's concern for us. And then we also begin to question what God is doing in other people's lives. It reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from C.S. Lewis in his book, The Horse and His Boy, where I'll just read it to you. It says, "Child," said the lion, "I am telling you your story, not hers. No one is told any story but their own." And if you're familiar with the Chronicles of Narnia, that's when Shasta is confused as he's introduced to this lion, Aslan, why Aslan had clawed his horse. And so he's concerned about the horse being clawed, and that's when he gets this little lecture. It's like, it's not your story. There's another story there, but it's not yours. I'm telling you your story. And that's one thing. This game of comparisons, comparing our lives with other people, is a dreadful game that we all play. And somehow we've got to stop playing that game. We got to stop looking at our lives and comparing it with other people and say, you know what? That's a story that God is working out. We have to do that in our own homes. Siblings need to do that among their own, their brothers and sisters. Each and every one of you have a story that God is writing. And that story, you don't know the beginning from the end, but God does. And it's unfolding. And you need to trust him in that story. You need to put yourself. And so here, Jairus has a story that's unfolding, and it's looking very bleak. And in this story, Jesus leaves to go to, seemingly overlooking him, to go heal a man who doesn't maybe even know that Jesus exists. Didn't know that Jesus was coming. The demon-possessed man didn't walk 1,000 miles to try to find Jesus. He didn't wasn't in desperation to find Jesus. Jesus was in desperation to find him. So Jesus stops everything he's doing to go pursue this man, while other people who are pursuing Jesus seem to be overlooked. You know, as I thought about that quote from C.S. Lewis, obviously, I believe C.S. Lewis probably drew it from the words of Jesus to Peter in John 21. It says, Peter, seeing him, meaning John, the apostle, said to Jesus, but Lord, what about this man? Jesus said to him, if I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you? You follow me. Basically, Jesus telling Peter, it's not your story. You have a different story. I'm working this story out. Don't compare your life with John's. They're going to look very different. But there's a key component in both your stories, and that's me. And we need to trust that Jesus is a part of our story. So once again, how long did Jairus have to wait? We don't know. But we do know that he did wait there. And when the boat is finally spotted, all those doubts going through his heart and mind, whether this was a fool's errand to try to find Jesus, and whether or not his daughter would die in the meantime, and she would not be healed, and he would come back to be scorned by his family for abandoning his daughter in her greatest time of need. And he might be thinking, you know, what have I done? You know, I could have been with my daughter right now. You know, he probably feels like maybe he is a fool. And you know, and we're in a trial. We are tempted to doubt God's concern in our life. You know, that's what trials do. They produce, and I'm reading right now, as I'm reading through the Bible, I'm in Job. Do you ever get afraid to read Job? Or is it just me? I'm afraid to read. I'm like, oh no, I'm coming to Job. You know, especially after you just read Esther. You know, it's almost such an inspiring story, and now I have to read Job. It scares you. Because, you know, God's going to allow him to go through a trial, and it's going to test him to see whether he trusts the Lord, that God is concerned about him. And as everyone's looking out, they see another boat coming, and this looks maybe a little bit bigger boat. They're trying to count people on the boat. Oh, well, I think this one looks like there's about 13 people on it. This could be it. Hope again rises, and as it gets closer and they see it's Jesus coming back, you can imagine the tears of hope in Jairus and the anticipation, kind of the like, wow, what if it's too late? But at least he's coming. And that brings us up to where we left off. So to me, maybe it's not important to you, but it's important to me to go from that verse to this verse where it just says Jesus shows up on the shore and here this man Jairus comes and falls at his feet. Like there's more to the story than that. So I like to imagine it. I hope that's okay with you. But let's pick up the story now in verse 22. So he saw him and he fell at his feet. And sometimes it takes desperate situations to bring us to the place where we should be. Anytime, but certainly where we should be in a time of trial, at the feet of Jesus. I want to encourage all of us here to make that the place we go when things are going well also. See, that's the challenge. When things go well, we tend to kind of stray and not be so diligent to put ourselves at the feet of Jesus. And when the trial comes, that tends to bring us to this place. And once again, you can imagine if Jairus had sided with the Pharisees, or if he had tried to stay neutral, how this trial had brought him to a place to say, you know what? I am going to go humble myself before Christ. I am going to fall at his feet, and I'm going to beg and plead with everything I have in me. And that's exactly what we read, verse 23. And he begged him earnestly, saying, my little daughter lies at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her that she may be healed and she will live. What I love about this, one of the most encouraging parts of this story, not only this story, but the one that we're also going to be seeing with the woman and her hemorrhage. This does not offend Jesus. We need to get this in our heads. Jesus is not offended by coming to him and begging and pleading for his help. He doesn't get put off. And this man is not put off by Jesus. You know, we have not because we ask not. And maybe in this case, we should think about how we have not maybe because we're unwilling to fall at Jesus' feet and beg with everything in us, to plead and beg and humble ourselves before him. It doesn't offend Jesus. And Jairus here is a good example of that. He makes an appeal for his little daughter. Now, this is interesting that he addresses his daughter as his little daughter. Luke tells us it was an only child, his only daughter. But when we see in the story, we learn something. All the gospel writers make it a point to tell us something about this girl. She's 12. Okay, raise your hand if you're 12. If you're 12 years older, maybe you're like 11 or 13. Okay, 11, 12, 13. Okay, you're kind of in that pocket. All right. If you're an 11 or 12-year-old, especially a little girl, do you like to be called little girl? No. Do you? No, you don't. I have an 11-year-old. Because you're not a little girl, are you? You're like on the threshold of becoming, you know, adulthood. You know, 13 and up. I mean, you're on your way. This is maturity. So we don't generally think of a 12-year-old as a little girl. But this is daddy's. You know, it's a daddy's girl. But I do believe, I'm not going to tell you this yet. I'm going to wait till the end. I have a feeling why Jairus calls his daughter his little girl, even though she's 12. But it could just be an affectionate title. It could be just maybe she was a diminutive girl. Maybe she was physically little. I don't think that that's what it was, but it could have been. But I have another theory, but I'm going to save that for later. But just imagine the immense relief that Jairus had when Jesus responds to him in the positive. I will come. I will come and lay my hands on your daughter. He answers the appeal. What elation must have been going through his heart. If only they could get there on time. But now what do they have? The Bible tells us there's a crowd thronging Jesus. You ever been late, you know, for somewhere? This happens all the time to me. It was like I'm late for something. I'm trying to get there in time. And then some traffic delay, you know. Or you just get stuck behind someone driving so stinking slow. You know, this is Texas. We like to move, you know. And I just like, oh my goodness, you know. I don't know. I have to confess. This is a sin. This is wrong. You know, you finally get the passing lane. You pass and you just glare at the person. I confess. I've done that. You just glare. It's like, who are you? It's like, why are you driving so slow? Move. You know, we got places to go, people to see, things to do. Well, and that's for trivial things. This man's got a daughter who's dying. She's on death's door, and there's a gaper's delay, you know, and Jesus is causing the delay. The very man he needs to get to his daughter is the very man causing the delay, because everywhere he goes, people want to be near him. Why wouldn't they? They're not concerned about Jairus. And by the way, this is something that is so important for every one of us to sink in. You could have a daughter on her deathbed, and you have a genuine need that Jesus is concerned about. But there may be a multitude around you who just doesn't get it because they have their own needs, their own things going on. And we have to be careful not to get offended that the whole planet doesn't stop because of our desperation, even though we feel it should. But there are 7 billion people on the planet, and Jesus is concerned about every single one of them. So in Jairus' mind, everybody should just part and move out of the way. But in everybody else's mind, what are they thinking? We want to be near Jesus. And they don't even know the story. So that's, and it says in verse 24, so Jesus went with him, and a great multitude followed him and thronged him. You know, just when Jesus shows up to the rescue, it's like all of a sudden other people's needs begin to take precedence. Maybe you can relate to that. When you feel like just as you're on a breakthrough, maybe with the Lord, that all of a sudden it just seems to you that he's becomes distracted by everybody else's needs, and you become second fiddle, and you're no longer in the spotlight like you believe you should be. And that's the wonder and the challenge of, you know, when Jesus was physically present in this world, he couldn't be everywhere at once. The space around him was limited. The bandwidth was limited. How many of you here wish that Jesus would choose today to go on a tour of the world so you could see him? You could see him, hopefully get in his presence, and even maybe touch the hem of his garment. Wouldn't you love that? I would love that. But let's look at the facts here. All right, we don't think about the facts. Let me tell you the facts. There are 1,440 minutes in a single day. There are 525,600 minutes in a single year. There are 52,560,000 minutes in 100 years. There are presently 7 billion people on the planet. If everyone booked a personal meeting with Jesus in the next 100 years, you would get 0.0075 seconds with Jesus, or minutes. And you know what that would be? That's the equivalent of less than half a second you would get with Jesus. And then who gets the priority? Who has the greatest needs? So if Jesus were on a 100-year tour and you booked early, and nobody after this year on the planet could book after that. It's only the people who live and exist today. If you're born tomorrow, sorry, you're not getting on the list. It's only the 7 billion people on the list. And you better not be late because you get a half second with Jesus. I don't know. I think I'd still sign up. I don't know about you, but I would. But you can see how impossible, and that's one of the reasons why Jesus said, I have to go, but I'm sending the Holy Spirit. Because he's not limited by time and space like Jesus was in a physical body here on this earth. But now we read, as things are going well, things make a turn for the better for Jairus. Verse 25, we see an interruption and a delay. And right in the middle of this story, it says, now a certain woman had a flow of blood for 12 years and had suffered many things from many physicians. She had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. 12 years is a long time to be losing blood. You want to talk about someone who's anemic. You want to talk about someone who's weak and sickly. Not only that, but this woman would be, as a Jew, would be ceremonially unclean. As long as she was bleeding, she'd be ceremonially unclean. She would not be allowed in the temple court of women. So she couldn't approach the presence of God, you know, at the temple. She would be, because of her ceremonial uncleanness, she really was not supposed to touch anybody else because she would make them ceremonially unclean and nobody could touch her. In fact, the furniture she would sit on or lie on would be considered unclean. And that's the way this woman had lived for 12 years, seemingly isolated from the presence of God. It says that this woman had suffered many things from many physicians. We have many physicians today as well. You know, we've got physicians in hospitals, family practices, group practices, urgent cares, clinics. But all of those might even be outnumbered by what I call the Google doctors. Do you know who the Google doctors are? Okay, the Google doctors. We know who Google. And sometimes these are informed, well-meaning, self-proclaimed experts on health and wellness. And I'm not saying that that's good or bad. I'm just saying they exist. And so we have licensed professional doctors, and we have a bazillion Google doctors. And whether we're talking about that licensed professional or the internet health enthusiasts, they can all fall short at times. Amen? They can all fall short. This woman, if she had Google, I believe this story might have read, and for 12 years she searched day and night on Google, tried every home remedy, tried every suggestion. She even used apple cider vinegar faithfully, 12 years, 365 days a year, 12 years, and still got worse. It actually says this woman suffered many things because of the doctors she went through. Now Jesus affirmed professional doctors, so we don't want to get that wrong. Jesus himself uses doctors in comparison with his own ministry. So he affirms doctors, but the point is that this woman is an example that you could even have the best doctors, you can spend all your money, you could search for 12 years on Google, and you may not be healed, and you may actually get worse. That's the reality. And that's the reality that this woman had lived. And it's a awful place to be. She has a great need. We don't know that she's not on death's door at this point. But she's desperate. She had suffered all of these things. And no doubt, I would say whether it was the doctors or even well-meaning neighbors in her life that said, try this, try that. No doubt some of those things did work for other people, but they didn't work for her. But she tried them all, day and night, 12 years, and she was suffering worse than she had when the malady began. Verse 27, when she heard about Jesus, she came behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. And this is audacity. Because she knows, she hears that Jesus heals people, but there is this timidity in her. There's this faith that's tenacious. Also this timidity that thinks, you know what? I can't approach him and make an appeal to him. I am unclean. He cannot touch me. She didn't know Jesus the way she should have. She didn't know that Jesus could touch a leper and a leper would become clean. Jesus would not receive leprosy. But you can imagine living 12 years of not being able to touch anybody or anybody touch you. And thinking, here's a holy man, a righteous man. The last thing I want to do is make this man unclean. But I am desperate. And I believe that if I can just sneak up to him and touch his garment, that this is going to be my cure. That's the faith that this woman had. And so we see that in verse 28. For she said, if only I may touch his clothes, I shall be made well. Immediately the fountain of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body she was healed of the affliction. Now we have to remember that before this happens, she also has to contend with that same multitude. So was she there in the multitude waiting? Was she there also listening to Jesus teach, trying to vie? Did her heart sink when she saw the boat leave the shore? Did she stay there like everybody else did in anticipation, knowing, I have this one chance and I need to take it? And so she is tenacious. And it's not just Jairus. This is a story of two people that will not give up. And so she presses in and she contends with the multitude. She gets within reach of Jesus. And it's almost like the runner in baseball, going in for the home run. He slides in. That's basically her slide. She's reaching. And the moment she touches him, she feels in her body supernatural power that courses through her, and she feels that she is healed. But she didn't anticipate that Jesus would ever know what she had done. And in verse 30 it says, and Jesus, immediately knowing in himself that power had gone out of him, turned around in the crowd and said, who touched my clothes? It's an intriguing passage because it says that Jesus felt power going out of him. Now, this is the only reference we have of this. We don't know whether Jesus always felt power going out of him when he healed people. Maybe he did. Maybe he didn't. We don't know. But we know in this case, he did. He felt power going out from him, and he wanted to know. because he knew something that everybody else around him didn't know, except the woman and himself. Now, there's no need to formulate any healing doctrines based on this one anecdotal story, this one reference. But nevertheless, we see this one case. But his disciples said to him, "You see the multitude thronging you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" So people are jostling Jesus at any given moment. It doesn't make any sense to them, but Jesus knew. There's rubbing up against Jesus, and there's touching Jesus by faith. And it's a difference. I'll tell you, and especially in church, this is the way I grew up. I grew up in a church where my life was always just rubbing up against Jesus with no faith, and nothing happens. You can go to church all your life and nothing could change in your life. Believe it or not, it's happened, continues to happen. Because you are not approaching Jesus with faith. And if you don't put your faith in Jesus, it doesn't matter how much you're around him in the church or outside of the church, it requires faith. And until I began to put my trust in Jesus, my life didn't change, even though I had grown up in church. So you have all these people bumping up against him, but this one woman touches him with faith. In verse 32, it says, "And he looked around to see her who had done this thing." Now, Jesus, we know in Jesus' part, because we know the story, Jesus is not trying to find her to put the hammer down. He doesn't want to reprimand her. He actually wants to honor her faith. He wants to meet this woman personally who had this faith, this audacity to reach out and touch him, believing in this healing. That's Jesus' perspective. He is full of compassion, but this woman doesn't know it. And that's why she's hiding, sneaking around, trying to just a hit and run. And then when he stops and she realizes that the gig is up, she's cowering in fear. Do you know, when I think about that, it reminds me of how I was before I came to Christ, where I was afraid to come face to face with Jesus. I was afraid because I was deceived. I didn't understand his compassion towards sinners. And I thought, I can't come face to face with Jesus. I'm unclean. I'm a terrible person. You know, I met a man yesterday at the market. His name was Graydon. And Graydon is an unclean man. Just put it this way. He was drunk when I met him. And an hour later when I was still talking to him, he was still drunk. Maybe even a little more so, because he was still drinking when we were talking. And the man had a foul mouth. He was exactly my age, and 46. And but he wanted to talk, and so we sat down. We talked for quite a while, and he said, "You know what? I'm a terrible person. I've done bad things. I'll probably continue to do bad things. I'm a sinner." And I said, "Well, you know what? God has compassion on sinners. It's probably better that you know that than to think that you're a good person and you don't need help." But here, this lady, she thinks that Jesus is going to put the hammer down on her. She's fearful. And yet, we need to realize, like she needed to realize, that Jesus is looking for us with compassion, not with a gavel. He's not looking to bring... Now, there is a day that the gavel comes out. No doubt. There's the last day and there's a judgment day. And the gavel will come out. But until that day, we can have confidence that Jesus is reaching out to you and to me and to Graydon with compassion. He wants to see people saved. He says, "I didn't come to judge. I came to save." So verse 33, it says, "But the woman, fearing and trembling..." Can you imagine? She just got healed of a sickness for 12 years. And this is her state of mind. She's afraid and she's trembling in the presence of Jesus, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. So here she is just blubbering. "I'm so sorry. I know I shouldn't have done it. I know I'm unclean, but I've been sick for 12 years. And you know, you've encountered people that are just overwhelmed. I'll be kind to the weaker vessel. But sometimes the weaker vessel can just break easier, you know, in these moments, in these tense emotional moments. And so there's this tense emotional moment, and she just falls apart. And of course, you can imagine Jesus like, "Time out, stop. I'm not here to you have nothing to be afraid of. I actually think this is a great story, and it's going to go down in history, and I'm going to have three of the Gospels all tell the story, because this is one of my favorite. This is one of Jesus' favorite stories, by the way. That's why he has it in three of his Gospels. A lot of stories never got recorded, but Jesus liked this one so much, he inspired through his Spirit the disciples to all tell this one. And what I love is his response. It says in verse 34, "And he said to her, 'Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction.'" This is the only time we have record of Jesus calling an adult woman daughter. In fact, it may be the only time he calls anybody, any woman, young, even young girl, daughter. This is the story of two daughters. We have Jairus pleading on behalf of his daughter, but we have a daughter of the Lord who says, I'm gonna be your advocate, and you're still my daughter. And Jesus refers to her as a daughter. And he declares, he says, your faith has made you well. Her faith played a part in this healing. But we also see that it was her faith was involved, the power of the Holy Spirit going through Jesus was involved, and the will of God was all involved in this healing. Now, this is where we don't have time today to delve into the subject of faith and healing. But in short, this is one of many anecdotal stories. We're told what happens here, but there's no extensive teaching given on this subject, which may or may not apply to other situations. There are examples of healing in the Bible where there's an absence of faith in the person. There are stories in the Bible where there are doubts in people's minds and they receive a healing. There are examples of people who had faith for somebody else and they received healings. There are examples of people who are healed who are absolutely ignorant of who even Jesus is. They don't even know. So how can they even have faith? They had no idea it was coming, and they were healed. But there are also examples in the Bible of people who had faith, loved the Lord, but were not healed of their sicknesses. So we see all of these examples. So we have to be careful not to build doctrines based on one story. But we do know in this story that faith did have a role in this woman being healed. There's no question about it. And I believe that we should have faith to be healed. But it's not the whole story. It doesn't answer every situation. There is one equation, by the way, for divine healing. That is, every divine healing involves one divine God who we serve and live and can make an appeal to. And we can plead and beg, and we can even, by faith, reach out and touch the hem of Christ's garment. And I love the words of Jesus' words of comfort and encouragement to this poor woman. In Luke, we find a little extra line here. It says to her, "Be of good cheer," because he saw that she was trembling and afraid. This "be of good cheer," the King James says, "be of good comfort." It means to have courage. He says, have courage. You know, don't be afraid. You can cheer up. This is not a time to be trembling before me. It's a time for us to rejoice and to dance. And if he wasn't on a mission to go raise a girl from the dead, they might have done a little more rejoicing right there. But in the meantime, and that's what we have for this story, her story. But in the meantime, what is Jairus thinking this whole time? Here it is again. Delay, interruption, someone else taking precedence over me. And what happens at this moment? Verse 35, while he was still speaking, he's talking to the woman. Some came from the ruler of the synagogue's house who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" So you can imagine what's going on is Jesus is interacting with the woman. Jairus is on the out, you know, close by watching it all. If it wasn't for the fact that his daughter was dying, this would have been a really wonderful moment. But the fact is they've been delayed. And in his mind, he's thinking, but my daughter's dying. My daughter's dying. Can we just get a move on? Can people just stop reaching out and touching Jesus? All right. It's only so much of Jesus to go around here, and I need him. And at that moment, the person finds Jairus, slips up to him and said, "She's dead. So don't." This is a fool's errand, Jairus. At that moment, if it wasn't for the words of Jesus, I think he would have just fallen in despair at that moment. I don't think, you know, the timing of this is providential because God knew that Jesus was going to raise this girl from the dead. But we only have three instances in the Bible of Jesus raising people from the dead. There was one before this. That was the widow's son in Nain. And certainly the news might have spread, but it was rare. Jesus, you know, for every 1,000 people Jesus healed or 10,000 people Jesus healed, we only have three occasions where he raised people from the dead. And up to this point, it had only been one. And certainly the rumors would probably went around like, no, did he really raise someone from the dead? That's a little bit too far-fetched. Didn't happen very often. And so the providence of this, where can you imagine if he had gotten news of his daughter's death? She might have been dead for a while, and it's been taking a while for the servant to go find where's Jairus. But whatever the case is, if he had heard that his daughter was dead before Jesus arrived back on shore, I don't think he would have stuck around to believe that Jesus would have raised her from the dead. That's just my opinion. I could be wrong. But I don't think he would have stuck around. So I think Jesus really, this is providence, and he wanted him. And so what Jesus says to him, and by the way, the third person is Lazarus. And as soon as Jesus heard the word that was spoken, he said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not be afraid, only believe." Once again, the compassion of Jesus. You know, and sometimes we feel like we're the person who's nothing ever goes right for us. We're always a day late and a dollar short. And every time we think there's going to be a breakthrough, someone else gets in the way and some other need is being met. And we see everybody else rejoicing. Everybody's happy that the woman with the blood flow is now, you know, clean again and healed. And yet my life is falling apart. Well, we're in good company then with Jairus. This is devastating news that his daughter's dead, but it doesn't devastate Jesus. He just tells him, don't be afraid, only believe. And he permitted no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. And then he came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue and saw a tumult and those who wept and wailed loudly. When he came in, he said to them, "Why make this commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." By the way, death is often referred, especially for Christians, as sleep in the Bible. I don't believe that that's necessarily some hold to the doctrine of soul sleep. I don't hold to that doctrine of soul sleep. That's the idea that when you die, you just go unconscious until the resurrection. I believe the Bible teaches otherwise, but still death is referred to as sleep because it's temporary. We are going to all be raised from the dead in the resurrection. But this served a dual purpose because Jesus did not want this miracle that he was about to do to be known. So he doesn't want to come in and announce, "Don't worry, people. I know she's dead, but I'm Christ, and I'm going to raise her from the dead, and then I'm going to show you what's for." Instead, he just tells them, "What are you making this commotion for? She's not dead. She's asleep." Because that's how he would refer to it anyway. But he also wants to keep this on the down low. He doesn't want to make a big splash. He wants to keep this from everybody. And it says that they look at their response. They ridiculed him. They ridiculed Jesus. What does he do? Yeah, I mean, that's part of his suffering that he suffered for us, is to receive ridicule from people like this. So he receives that ridicule, but then he does something else. He puts them all out. And there's a time when you just put out the ridicule, all right? Just get it out of there, you know? So he puts them all out. It's like, get out of here. She's just asleep. I don't want to hear your nonsense. You'll see. I'm just going to go wake her up. And then it says he took the girl by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kumi," which is translated, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." Now this is kept in the original language. That's the language he spoke in, and everything we're reading here would have been spoken in that language. But the writers of the Gospels keep this little section, "Talitha kumi, little girl, I say to you, arise." Now I told you I had a theory of about this little girl and why Jairus calls his 12-year-old daughter little girl, and that the gospel writers all make a point to tell us she was 12. Here's my theory. I believe that the little girl here, it was meant to be an emotional tug, potentially, on Jesus. You know, Jesus not knowing. You know, can you imagine Jairus going through, what is it going to take to get Jesus? And if I tell him it's a little girl, then he'll be more moved with compassion for a little girl. Not that a 12-year-old you can't have compassion on, but there's just something so adorable about a little girl. And certainly if we could tug on Jesus' heartstrings. Now, I could be wrong on this, but this is why I think it could have been why he calls her little girl to Jesus. And why Jesus, when he comes and sees a 12-year-old, says, little girl, I say to you, arise. Not upset at Jairus, not there to reprimand him, but also acknowledging with a wink, you know, all right, here's your little girl. She's 12 years old. And why I believe that all the gospel writers make it a point to tell us she's 12, because they would know, and especially in that culture, that 12 is, they would consider nearly an adult, not a little girl, but someone who's on that threshold of adulthood. And in verse 42, and immediately the little girl arose and walked, and she was 12 years of age. Notice, they want to make that point. Because if they didn't tell us, what would you have in your mind? Maybe a 2-year-old even, maybe a 3-year-old, maybe someone who couldn't walk, maybe 1 year old, you know, maybe a baby. But it says that she arose and walked, for she was 12 years old. And they were overcome with great amazement. Of course, they were. But he commanded them that strictly that no one should know of it, and he said that something should be given to her to eat. So the story ends with Jesus looking to the practical. The girl had been sick, probably not had eaten for days, and all their rejoicing, they may forget, she's got an empty stomach, and though Jesus raised her from the dead, he didn't miraculously put food in her stomach. And there are some things he expects us to do. And so he tells them, okay, I know you want to like dance a jig right now, but I healed the girl, I raised her from the dead, she's going to be hungry, make sure she has food, and I know that we're all hungry, and you need food, because your stomachs are growling too. So we're going to close in prayer, and Pastor Doug's going to come up and lead us in a closing prayer, or a closing song. But I want us to remember that the main part of both these stories is desperation and approaching Jesus and finding that he is compassionate to us. That's the main part of this story. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for having compassion on all of us. Thank you that we are all sick spiritually in need of healing. Some of us are sick physically and are in need of healing. And we can come to you and we can plead before you. And you have the power to both heal us of our sicknesses, and you have the power to heal us of our sin. And Lord, you have the power to raise us from the dead, which you will. And so we put our trust in Jesus Christ. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.